Hi everyone, this is Bethan. I'm at the Mind State Society event today at the Royal Society of Medicine in London. And we've just finished the morning session today. And I am really excited because I am about to interview Dr. Louise Hyde from Birkbeck University of London. I got that right, didn't I? She gave a fantastic presentation earlier on asylum, social exclusion and scandals. So we're going to talk a little bit about you first. Do you want to tell us a bit about your perspective? What perspective you come from, because you're a historian, aren't you? You're not a clinician or an academic clinical researcher.
That's right, yes. So I'm an academic historian and I'm a social and cultural historian. And my area really is on psychiatric institutions. So my earlier work was very much on 19th century asylums. And I'm now working on 20th century institutions. I'm interested in the deinstitutionalisation process, but more specifically, I'm looking at some of the very big and very important inquiries into abuse in psychiatric hospitals that were held in the early 1970s. And I'm interested in what those inquiries and what the documentation underlying those inquiries can tell us about institutional cultures, cultures of harm, and how those cultures evolve in institutional settings over a long period of time, and where they are often not seen, or they become part of the institution to a degree in which they're sort of almost invisible, but they are also very harmful.
Thank you. I think that's a really good introduction. And you talked an awful lot about that in your presentation, didn't you? And that's something that really struck with me, how the culture and attitudes can build over time to a point where maybe 10, 20, 30 years, you're unable to see where motives or reasons for practices came from. Do you get?
Yeah.
Or maybe I haven't explained that very well.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think just going back as a historian, going back to the early 19th century, when we start to see what we would now think of as small public institutions that were built for people who were experiencing mental distress, the driving force, the impetus for that was very humanitarian. You know, the intentions were very good. It was to help people who were otherwise very much at the sort of mercy of what might have been a very hostile environment that they were living in. So what I'm saying is, and then gradually those institutions that were small to begin with, over time got bigger and bigger and bigger as more and more people were sent to these institutions. So what I'm saying is that there are lessons to be learned. There are things that resonate with us today, I think, in terms of some of the smaller care homes that are now, we're looking at larger purpose-built care homes.
I'll come back to that in a bit, because we had a question from Twitter whilst we had questions from the audience. Do you want to give a brief overview of what your presentation was about? You've covered some of it, haven't you? But to give a bit more about what you talked about.
So what I'm really looking at is, as a starting point, the looking at some of the inquiries from the early 70s, and to look at where the large mental hospitals, as they were called, where they had got to at that point in terms of providing very, very, very poor standards of care and neglect and abuse, particularly for older people. People who were often very isolated, they may well have spent many years in the institution themselves, and many of them didn't have family members to advocate for them either. And the ways in which ideas around, very ageist ideas around old people, that people living with dementia, that this was an inevitable part of getting old, that nothing could be done, that these were so-called hopeless cases, and that people were really left to languish on the wards in very inhumane conditions, basically. And what I'm saying is that the inquiries can show us where we got to, how we got to that particular point. So it's the other point that I was making is around isolation. So part of it is around isolation of the institutions outside communities, but also the isolation that's experienced by patients who are inside the wards, and also by the staff who become very socially and professionally isolated as well. So there's this concept of isolation, I think, is really, really important.
Definitely. Mm. You talked about and you told us about heartbreaking things about people not moving from beds, and being left there with no occupation. How did we get to that point? So you've mentioned isolation. Mm. Was finance involved in it any way? Were these institutions not funded well, or was it more to do with attitudes?
Both, but okay. Finance funding is always going to be a big issue. So it was in the 19th century as much as in the 20th. By putting people in bed, by keeping people in bed, makes it much easier to manage people, basically. Mm-hmm. So they don't move around, they are sort of subjected to the sort of disciplines and routines of the ward. But obviously their quality of life is close to zero, because they're not actually occupied. So one of the things that actually happened in the 1960s was that people started to, and this didn't happen in every hospital, of course, but there were specific hospitals where this did happen, where a lot of older people were simply put to bed because they were seen as being old and as having, because they were old, having particular mental and physical conditions, and so they were put to bed.
It's just deeply distressing, isn't it? I seem to remember, I think it was from your presentation, about the economic argument for keeping people in bed and in locked wards, and the two-tier system you were talking about. So people who they thought might get better and could be reintroduced into the community, they were on different wards, were they?
That's right, yeah. So basically people tended to, in the old asylums, and this is not in every institution, of course, because there were many institutions and wards where people did receive the best possible care that they could, that could be provided. And so these inquiries tend to relate to a few wards and a few hospitals.
Okay.
So that's not to say that, so really what was happening, but after the Second World War, there was a huge dearth of funding. There was a real move to try and close all these big institutions because they were so dilapidated and they didn't want to spend any money on them. So the conditions were very poor, and they wanted to move people into the community where people would have a better standard of life. And part of that in the 1950s that sort of advanced that idea was when the new drugs were introduced that could help people to control some of their symptoms, which meant that they didn't need institutional care any longer and they could live in the community if they took their drugs. So that was another.
And that brings something that clicked in my mind when you said people lying in bed and they weren't a management problem necessarily, for the staff. A lot of service users say that medication can do it very much the same, can make you very drowsy and mean that you don't cause any trouble for staff or people, but you're doing that at home in the community. Mm-hmm. Do you see any parallels between that or
Well, I think there are lots of ways. I mean, there are lots of ways of controlling people's behaviours, and in that post-war period, these places were very, very badly staffed, poorly staffed. So not only were there not many staff, they were very short-staffed, but many of the staff who were there were very poorly trained as well. Okay. So they didn't have the sort of training that obviously that you would have now. But so they were trained in a very different way. So psychiatric nurses were sort of trained to. Yes, they were trained to care for patients, of course they were, but they were also trained to make sure that the wards looked neat and tidy and clean. And so there was, so in some ways, particularly on the wards where you have a lot of long stay patients who are not expected to get better, so some of the nurses become more, for their own sort of job satisfaction, interested in making sure that the ward looks good. So, yeah.
So I'm going to move a bit to today now. Mm-hmm. What can we learn and how can we learn from the closure of the asylums mm-hmm. and community care?
Well, I think one of the things that we can learn is to look at how, because since the closure of the big hospitals, or most of them, in the 1980s and 90s, we've now seen the entire sort of history of the asylum system, basically, from when it started in the late 18th, early 19th century, right through for sort of 150 or so years to the 1980s and 90s. And so we can see all the events, all of the different ideologies that created them, all the different sort of discourses, and all of the huge events also that had a very, very big impact. And I think perhaps one of the main reasons for why the asylums became what they became in the 1950s and 60s were the two wars, because that was the time when people were moved out. People were moved out from their institutions and put into other institutions to make way for the military. And also all the nurses and doctors, many of the nurses and doctors went to war. Okay. And so they were very, very badly, poorly staffed. There was terrible disease, starvation during both of the wars. And so by the end of the Second World War, so advances were made from this sort of 1930s in particular, and then again everything got shut down again as soon as the war came along. So after the war, you end up with a situation where a lot of these institutions were in a very, very bad state indeed. And then some lots of new ideas started to be introduced from the late 1940s and 50s, and this was the sort of beginning of the whole therapeutic deinstitutionalisation process.
Right. Now, I'm going to ask, just before we finish, I'm going to ask you a question from Mr. Keir Harding, because if I don't ask you a question, he will annoy me forevermore on Twitter. So, Keir asks a question. Have the asylums gone away, or have we privatised them, made them smaller, made receptions look like hotels, and carried on making the people who experience distress live in warehouses in the countryside? That's typical Kia.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, I don't think there's a sort of straightforward answer to that. So I think...
have they gone away, or are we seeing their reemergence?
No, I think that... there are resonances from history, so we're never going to see the same asylums again as they were. But there will be different forms of institutional care, and I think what we can do is to learn from the asylums, which is they were isolated and they were too big. And they allowed certain, environments, very harmful environments and practices to take place without much being done about it until the 1950s. So I think that what will happen is, no, we won't see the old asylum system, but we can learn lessons from what did happen from with the asylums to make sure that the new emerging ways in which care is provided, particularly long-term care, that we don't make the same mistakes, so that they are not built in isolated locations, that they do not get too big, and that they are regularly monitored, and that you have constantly new people coming in who can see things that people who've been there for a long time don't see.
Because that's a form of isolation, isn't it?
Yes,
staff,
that's right.
Being there, either you've got the geographical isolation,
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
presuming, but also the isolation of turnover of staff, people being there a long
time. And they people become professionally isolated, yeah, and socially isolated as well. So it's a very, very big issue, yeah.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I could talk to you for an hour.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.